This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When my guest Johnny Greenwood was primarily known as the lead guitarist and keyboardist for the rock band Radiohead, screenwriter and director Paul Thomas Anderson asked Greenwood to write the score for his film There Will Be Blood. It was an unexpected turn for Greenwood, but he was immediately noticed. The score was described in Rolling Stone as a sonic explosion that reinvented what film music could be. Greenwood wrote scores for Anderson's subsequent films, including Phantom Thread and The Master, which opened like this. That's a pretty great way to start a film. Greenwood also writes a lot of film music that's more avant-garde, but some of the avant-garde music is influenced by his love of Baroque. He studied classical music when he was young, played in a youth orchestra, and has been a composer in residence at the BBC Concert Orchestra. Now you can hear his music in three very different new movies: Anderson's Licorice Pizza, which is set in the 70s, Spencer, starring Kristen Stewart as Princess Diana, and The Power of the Dog, which is set in Montana in 1925. In the beginning of The Power of the Dog, two brothers who own a large cattle ranch are herding the cattle to market. This is the music we hear. Johnny Greenwood, welcome to Fresh Air. I love your music. It's a pleasure to have you on our show. So that music that we just heard from The Power of the Dog, it starts like it's going to be very Western-ish, but not quite. And then there's other potentially menacing music intruding on it. It's a buzzy, ominous-sounding melody interfering with this Western-ish kind of sound. So, and it lets you know that this isn't going to be a conventional Western, even though they're herding cattle. And it also lets you know that bad things are going to be interfering. What's happening musically? What are you doing musically?
I think Westerns have a traditional sound, which is big sweeping strings and sort of Copland-style harmonies, which are not only beyond me, but wouldn't have really suited the darkness of the film, I think. So the approach to this was originally to try and write music for banjo and string quartet, because I'm a big believer that the banjo can be a great, dark, sinister instrument. I mean, I grew up listening to things like the Violent Femmes, and they managed to do that sort of country death song style, you know, banjo as you know, the opposite of the Steve Martin, you know, right. routine about how banjos just make you smile, which is true. And, you know, and all that stuff is wonderful music. But there's also a dark side, I think, to that kind of music. Anyway, I persuaded her to let me try and write something for banjo and string quartet. And it was awful, as you might imagine, and just sounded wrong in every way. So on the rebound from that, I just started trying to play my cello like it was a banjo. So doing the rolling finger picking thing on a cello instead.
So with the strings that kind of interfere with that plucked cello sound, making the sound even more unconventional, what did you do to get that kind of menacing sound from violins or violins and violas?
So I had them play with no vibrato, and, you know, that's a really beautiful effect in a way. I think the danger with writing music not on paper and relying on computers and demos is that you start to get used to how some string sounds and then just look to replicate that. Whereas the variety of colour that, you know, one player can make with a string instrument is quite mind-blowing. And just the combination of a whole ensemble and all the directions it can go, it's really exciting and daunting. And it's easily my favourite day of the year is when the string players turn up for an afternoon.
Do you want the strings to be perfectly tuned, or do you want them to be just slightly off?
Okay. Yes. I wrote one cue for the Lynn Ramsey film, You're Never Really Here. We're asking them to have half the players tuned a quarter tone flat, so just a little bit out of tune, but all as out of tune as one another, if you see what I mean. But because they're playing with their ears, it's very hard to do. So they're still making their fingers go to where their ear wants to hear the right note. So even though it was difficult to do and they were sort of weren't doing it properly, it was one of those things where you just end up being even more impressed by what they can do and how they're playing and thinking and making these sounds. So yeah, I get all, you know, all very excited and fanboy about string players. I mean, whenever I see somebody, you know, walking into Abbey Road and they're carrying their cello and going to do a string session, I just know how many hours and days of their life they've spent rehearsing, you know, every day for 4 hours, 3, 4, 5 hours. And then you get to hear the results of that. And it's very daunting. And I admire the musicians who give their life to that, really.
One of your influences who you've also worked with is Krzysztof Penderecki, an avant-garde composer who once said that we have to use instruments which were built 300 years ago or 200. And the newest instrument in the orchestra is the saxophone, but that's at least 100 years old. And he said, in the century of landing on the moon, he said this during the 20th century, we still have to write for very old instruments, museum instruments. I think this is the problem. It became the problem in the second half of the 20th century that there's not much progress because of the lack of instruments, of new instruments. And I thought of you when I read that, and this is quoted on an album that you collaborated with him in on. I thought of you because it seems to me you want to make old instruments sound new by messing them up a little bit, by doing unusual things with them or having them do unusual things with each other, whether it's their tunings or their dissonances, the number of instruments you use. So do you relate to that quote about using old instruments for new music?
I do, because I've always found acoustic instruments, certainly orchestral instruments, to be capable of much more variety and strangeness and complexity than, you know, nearly all of the software I've used in the past. And I think that's maybe why, to me, music by people like Penderecki and Ligeti and it just still sound very strange and contemporary, and they still sound like the music of the future to me, whereas lots of the electronic stuff that was done in the 60s and 70s, you hear it now and it's sort of its time.
Oh, that's so true. That is really true.
And I think that all instruments are just technology, however old or new they are. And the ideal situation is where you can just regard them as being all on the same level of importance and interest. And whether it's a piano or a laptop or an electric guitar or a tuba, they're all hugely exciting things, you know. And I remember as a 10-year-old, whenever my mum was driving us around, if we went past a music shop, my daydream as we drove past was never imagine being able to go in and buy a guitar or whatever. It would be imagine being able to go and buy a flute or a trumpet. I was just fascinated with all these different colours and ways of making music and making sounds. And in a really tragic middle-aged man kind of way, that's sort of what I've turned my life into, as I'm sitting talking to you, surrounded by lots of, you know, those kind of instruments.
But I'm wondering, getting back to that Penderecki quote, I'm wondering if you tried to make old instruments sound just a little bit unrecognizable and use them in a way that sounds new, even though the instrument is old. You know, that sounds like a new sound that you're getting from it.
So I was very lucky when I was in elementary school, age 9, 10, that we were sitting with our teacher and he had everyone bring in their instruments, whether it was recorders or violins. And he said, okay, everyone try and make a new sound with your instrument. Try and get a different noise out of it. And that really stuck with me. That was just something that fascinated me then. And is probably, you know, still in my how I work today. So yeah, just very grateful to have, you know, great music teacher at an early stage of my life.
Do you remember what you did to get a different sound?
I think I put the bow under the strings and played the bottom string and top string at the same time, as I remember. But just realizing that there were really no rules, and if it makes a sound, then it's musical, and you can just look at an instrument and think about it in any way you want to.
I want to talk with you about the music for Phantom Thread. There's three versions of what's basically like the theme of the movie, and I want to play two of those versions. And we're going to start with version two. And I should say, at this point, the movie is about this very kind of classical fashion designer who is both obsessive and very set in his ways and very temperamental. And he deals, you know, he does like gowns and other evening dresses for, you know, high society, wealthy women. And so when we hear this music, his muse-girlfriend is about to start poisoning him with mushrooms, because when he isn't feeling well, when he's vulnerable, he becomes more accessible and more affectionate and needy. And that puts her in a better position, she thinks. So this is a duet with you at the piano and Daniel Piorro on violin. I think that is really just a beautiful theme, just everything is like just a little bit off. I'm wondering if the piano that you're playing there is prepared in any way, because the notes sound imperfectly tuned and a little bit muffled maybe. So what have you done with the piano?
There's a roll of felt laid between the hammers and the strings, which is why it sounds like that. And it's a little bit out of tune just because I'm a bit lazy with my booking the piano tuner, I'm afraid. But that one.
It's not because you like the sound, it's because you're lazy?
It's because I like the sound, yes. And I'm lazy.
So you have felt under the lid, like on the strings, as opposed to like on the keys. They're on the felt is on the strings.
Yes.
And the violin, it's almost like you asked him, I want to hear the friction of the bow on the strings.
Well, Daniel is a very physical player indeed, and is interested in every possible color and texture. And I also love a recording where you can hear the physicality of what's happening, whether it's the breathing of the player or the effort involved in making the music, you know. And I know it drives some people crazy, but things like Glenn Gould singing along and all of that reminder that there's all this muscle and physical effort behind the making of the music, I just makes it you know, more exciting to me. I think that stuff is quite often clinically stripped out in most people's consumption of music, and especially classical music.
So let's hear another version of the theme that we heard from Phantom Thread. And this happens as the fashion designer is really feeling the effects of the poison, and she's cooking more of those poison mushrooms. And so he's been talking to his sister, and he's been complaining about his muse, and he doesn't realize he's being poisoned by her. But he says, there's an air of quiet death in this house, and I do not like the way it smells. And he's really referring to the woman who's poisoning him when he says that, although he doesn't know that she's poisoning him. So here we go. This is a more orchestral version and a more dirge-like version of the theme that we heard. This is from The Phantom Thread, music composed by my guest, Johnny Greenwood. I just love that. And I'm not sure exactly what to ask you, but can you talk a little bit about shaping it into that version of the theme?
Sure. I mean, I'm a big fan of these historically very inaccurate recordings of Baroque music that were done in the 70s, 60s, 70s, 80s, even before the authenticity police stepped in and made everyone play with the right size of orchestra and the right kind of violins. And because it's sort of glorious hearing this Baroque music done with big romantic orchestras, for all that it's, you know, would never have sounded like that. So that was a reference I sent to Paul. And he was also talking about that Kubrick film, Barry Lyndon, that has some big Baroque orchestral things in it. And it was just, you know, I mean, on one level, another excuse to get in a room with an orchestra and just revel in that beautiful big sound they make.
You started writing film scores because Paul Thomas Anderson asked you to write music for There Will Be Blood. What was your first reaction when he asked you to do something you'd never done before? Had you ever thought about doing film scores?
No, I hadn't. My reaction when Paul asked me was just excitement that I was going to get access to musicians and be able to write music for someone. And the fact that it was for a film, I didn't really, up until that time, pay that much attention to film music, really. And I just thought, this is going to be a bit like being in a band with somebody, except I'm in a band with Paul and the people who are making this film and going to be contributing music to it. And as a way to disassociate from it, I suppose, and feel like it's not really to do with me. And when I started thinking like that, I just found it really enjoyable and fun to throw lots of music in his direction.
Do you find it helpful to know that I have to write music that fits this mood or that fits this scene, and there's a purpose that defines what the music has to be? Is that helpful in digging out, you know, music from your brain to know what it's for?
It is, but I mean, there's a few cues in Phantom Thread that were written specifically for the scene they're in, but they're the minority, really. It's usually more a case of writing music about the characters or the scenery or the story itself. Like in There Will Be Blood, I remember being really taken with the story of HW and this sort of abandoned boy being taken. And I enjoyed writing quite a lot of, I suppose, quite sentimental music for that. And, you know, I enjoyed that easily as much as writing the more atonal and stranger, you know, relatively stranger orchestrations and things. And I try and avoid things like click tracks. So quite often the players are just being asked to play 2 or 3 minutes of music, and the poor editor or director have to just, you know, put up with something that might not fit to picture, or even move the picture around so it fits the music. But this is partly from just trying to avoid computers as being the arbiter in how music is played and how, you know, how tempos are conducted. And we'll just ask the players to play something, you know, in 3 or 4 different tempos, and then do the work in the edit into making things work with the film itself.
When you write for a movie, are you seeing the footage of the scene you're writing for before you compose it, or are you composing it before it's even shot?
Usually a lot of it gets written when I see the first test footage, or just see early footage of, like with Jane Campion's film, it was seeing all of the footage of New Zealand that was standing in for Montana, and just seeing the colours of the film and understanding the script and the characters. And that's, I mean, that's already lots of really, you know, fertile ground to start writing music. And I'd rather write twice as much music as needed and just keep going, rather than panic about, you know, dropping the level of the music at the right place so a line of dialogue can be fitted in exactly in the right second. And so I'm very indulged in that way, in that I'm allowed to start at work very early while films are being, you know, shot, or even before.
You started studying classical music when you were a child. How did you go in that direction? Was it through school? Were you assigned an instrument? Did your parents listen to classical music?
No, there was never really music playing in the house other than from my older sister, Susan. But in terms of classical stuff, I think it was just because I was given a plastic recorder when I was 6 as a surprise present. And then I had 5 years where I was at a primary school where I was told that no one was allowed to play the recorder until they were 11. And this just became this instrument of total, you know, fascination and frustration. It's like, why can't I just couldn't wait to start. So I think it was just that old story of, you know, of denial, making something seem just, you know, all the more delicious. And once I started playing recorder, I, you know, I kept at it seriously till I was 18. You know, I still play it now.
Okay, a recorder is a wind instrument, but you had a plastic one. Now, I had a plastic one in 6th grade because we all had to play ensemble plastic recorders, which were known as flutophones. And you know, the ones we had, I don't know about yours, but the ones we had, it was as if a wooden recorder mated with a kazoo and came up with this kind of annoying sound that was only heightened when there were 30 of them playing ensemble. So was yours a flutophone or a recorder? Like, how did it sound?
I mean, I'm sure it sounded gruesome, but I was impressed with myself enough to sit in my room playing it all day. But yeah, it was just a Baroque-style recorder made of creamy yellow plastic by the Hohner Corporation in 1979 or whatever it was.
So I know you love Baroque music. You've loved it since childhood. Is there an example from one of your scores in which you feel you especially drew on your love for Baroque?
I mean, I keep doing it. It's the brutal truth. Like even in Spencer's score, there's lots of things that are very, you know, influenced. And I'm using influence in the same way that, you know, a bank can be influenced by robbers, I think. So it's very... So, yes, you know, but that's only because all of that stuff, all of you know, Bach and Handel and Haydn, it's all chord sequences and that are still being used today. And it's that thing where, you know, music changed after that, but it didn't necessarily do anything too different.
Why don't we hear that section of the score? And this is Johnny Greenwood's music from the film Spencer about Princess Diana. That's music from Johnny Greenwood's soundtrack for the new film Spencer about Princess Diana. So before you were with Radiohead, my understanding is you were in a band with Tom York's younger brother. Tom York is the lead singer, songwriter from Radiohead. So your older brother was in a band with Tom York. You were in a band with Tom York's younger brother. Do I have that right?
You do. That's right.
So how did you end up playing with Tom York and forming Radiohead?
Well, they had a keyboard player who, it's Tom's band, had a keyboard player, which I think they didn't get on with because he played his keyboard so loud. And so when I got the chance to play with them, the first thing I did was make sure my keyboard was turned off when I was playing. And I must have done months of rehearsals with them with this keyboard that was just, they didn't know that I'd already turned it off and was just, they made quite a racket, quite a noise. It was all guitars and distortion. And so I would pretend to play for weeks on end. And Tom would say, I can't quite hear what you're doing, but I think you're adding a really interesting texture that, because I can tell when you're not playing. And I'm thinking, no, you can't, because I'm really not playing. And I'd go home in the evening and work out how to actually play chords. And cautiously over the next few months, I would start turning this keyboard up. And that's how I started, you know, started in with Radiohead.
Wait a minute. I want to make sure I understand this correctly. So the first period that you were playing with Radiohead, you turned off the keyboard.
Yeah.
And so you were
sure,
fingering the keys, but no sound was being emitted because this is an electric keyboard. So
exactly,
nothing was coming out and nobody noticed.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we were kind of noisy garage band, I suppose, in a small rehearsal room. And I remember the first few songs when I did start playing melodies and Tom liked it and it was very exciting.
So since you've had a foot in classical music and in rock for so long and have been important in both worlds, I think the division has melted away for a lot of classical performers, but not so much for other people because so many people don't listen to classical music at all anymore. It's just not... I think it's become more and more of a niche, with the exception of film scores. That's one of the great things about film scores, is that it brings a different kind of music often into, you know, into people who otherwise wouldn't hear it.
I think streaming has been quite bad for classical music, because if you are keen to find out more about classical music, you might have heard that the Beethoven Violin Concerto is a great piece of music. So you go on to Spotify or whatever, and when you search for it, you're presented with 500 recordings. And it's just, I think it's just a bit of a sort of daunting and off-putting thing. There's very little curation and very little... And plus, you're made to feel like it's just, you know, that it's somehow beyond you, and it's which is really sad, I think. I do sort of mourn the days when you used to listen to a record hundreds of times and get everything you could out of it. And I'm the same. I'll listen to a Miles Davis record on Spotify, and then rather than play it again, I'll move on to the next one. And there's just none of that sort of obsession. And I think classical music especially suffers with that, because if you can, you know, live with the same piece of classical music for a few weeks, you know, it'll reveal itself to you. But it's about having the patience to do that.
I know you like performing in churches and listening to music in churches, because often the period of music that's being played is from the period that the church was built in. Correct me if I'm wrong here, but can you talk a little bit about that, about the experience of being like in an old church or cathedral and playing or hearing music there?
Yeah, so I'm spending a lot of time in Italy at the moment, and the churches there have just some glorious and strange organs that I've been really lucky enough to play and write a few things for. That's opened up a whole side of classical music I didn't know about, like all these early organs that have two sets of black keys so that you can play the notes in between the notes, a bit like Penderecki, I suppose. And it have keys that reproduce the sound of birds singing. And if you look inside the organ, it's these little boxes with water in that blow air through them. And these instruments are, you know, 400 or 500 years old. And it just occurred to me that when you're sitting hearing one being played, you are hearing an actual authentic performance from that would be identical to someone sitting in the same chair 500 years earlier, because the walls are the same and the pipes are the same and the organ is the same, and this is what it sounded like. And there's a sort of exciting time travelery sort of enjoyment to be had with that kind of music, I think.
You've kind of made these organs sound like synthesizers, you know, with, you know, microtonal possibilities, bird sounds. Yeah.
Sure. Well, you know how, I don't know what you know about music notation. I don't want to patronize you at all, but you know that like F sharp is a higher note than G flat, even though on a keyboard it's the same black key. But when you play in a different key, that note really should be slightly higher. And when you're in the previous key, it should be slightly lower. So when you're playing in like E major and you have your D sharp, that's a higher note than an E flat in C minor. So that fluidity is something that these early organs tried to get past by having these, by doubling up the keys. So you use one of the black keys when you want to play an E flat and the other black key when you're calling it a D sharp, for example.
What you said was definitely not patronizing, because I had no idea that there'd be a difference between a D sharp and an E flat. They're, on the piano, it's the same black key. So I always think of it as being the same.
Sure. But string players are always taught that, you know, you push the second finger higher for your F sharp, and F sharp is very nearly a G when you're playing in D major. But, you know, but if you're playing a minor scale or a minor key, then you put your finger in a slightly different place. Yeah, it's strange. It is bizarre, isn't it? It is very strange. But for whatever reason, it totally works when you hear it.
Johnny Greenwood, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for your music. And I'm expecting one or more of your scores to be nominated for Oscars. So, you know, I don't know if you care very much about awards, but I wish you good luck in award season.
Thank you. Thank you, Terry.
Johnny Greenwood wrote the scores for three new movies, Licorice Pizza, The Power of the Dog, and Spencer, and is Radiohead's lead guitarist. This is Fresh Air.